Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revolution 250 podcast. I am Bob Allison. I chair the Rev 250 Advisory Group. We are a consortium of about 70 groups in Massachusetts looking at ways of commemorating the 250th anniversaries of American independence. And our guest today is Mark Schmidt. And Mark Schmidt has had an interesting career in the world of public history, being the director of the Museum of World War II in Natick and the Winslow House, a 1699 house in Marshfield, Massachusetts, also director of the Falmouth Historical Society. I could go on with his various accomplishments, but he comes to us today as the executive director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. So, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Allison. Thank you for having me.
And so I know the Mayflower Society is descendants of those who came over on the Mayflower, but you're now taking this in a new direction, and one is looking at connections between the Mayflower and the American Revolution.
Correct. And it's for people that don't know what the Mayflower Society is, it's a lineage and membership society that was formed in 1897. It's actually a consortium of 54 almost independent or franchise, for lack of a better word, societies. Each of the 50 states has their own member society, as well as Washington, D.C., Europe, Canada, and Australia. And so it was, again, originally formed in 1897 as the Mayflower Society. But it really even had its start back in 1876, when people on the 100th anniversary of the Revolution really started getting into interested in their own past. And they wanted to look up their own lineage. And so these societies began. The first one was in New York, and then followed by a couple others. The Massachusetts one was formed in 1894. And in 1897, they combined the first five or six to become the Mayflower Society. So what we do is, to become a member, you have to prove your lineage, that one of your ancestors was one of the people on the Mayflower in 1620. So you have to, we go back and prove back 14, 15 generations that your ancestor was one of those people who had children in the original Plymouth Colony, but came over on the Mayflower. Now, you alluded to something that was started a few years ago by a woman named Muriel Cushing, who's down in Florida, but she's a General Society of Mayflower Descendants member. And what she's got is something called the Patriots to Passengers program. Now, for us, the Mayflower Society is relatively new to the Revolution 250 organization. We're very pleased to be part of it. But we've shown that there's clearly some lineage that are people that were able to prove their lineage back to the American Revolution, but we're kind of wondering what their prior lineage was as well. And so what this Patriots to Passenger program shows is maybe they're missing like the first four or five generations that go back to 1620 from 1775, mm-hmm. 1776. So there is definitely a tie-in between passengers that came to and formed Plymouth Colony and later led on to Lexington and Concord and beyond. Mm-hmm. So there was a definite tie-in. For us, being here in Plymouth, Massachusetts, we mm-hmm. want to be involved and show just how these descendants and the town mm-hmm. was involved in the Revolution. So it's an important partnership for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Mark, there are only about 100 people on this boat. How many descendants are there?
And out of the like 28 that really had children that we know, there's probably as many as 30 to 35 million worldwide.
Wow. So 28 people.
Yeah. And
in 1620, now 35, that's an amazing
statistic. It truly is. And the Mayflower Society has received well over 100,000 members in its time. Right now we have over 30,000 active members, mm-hmm. Nationwide, worldwide, and we're very proud of that. And again, it's not the easiest club to get into. You got to do some work to show your 14 to 15 generations, and we've got a staff to show that Mark Schmidt or Robert Allison. Yeah, maybe you're an Alden descendant, maybe you're not, but we'll help show if you are or you're not.
Okay. So you get, so how would someone become a member? I mean, how would they start the process?
Okay. Obviously you show an interest and an inclination in lineage. Mm-hmm. So each of these member societies, your membership would go through them. So you can apply to Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Mississippi, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wyoming, whatever it's you so choose. We have what they call an historian who works with you, and you get your work, your papers in line. We have a publication called what we call the Silver Books, which shows the first five generations. Mm-hmm. So that can give you a little help, but then you've got to show that, generations 8, 9, 10 on to present day continued, and there's not any interrupted or questioned line that can show that your descent goes back to this. It can get difficult, especially in like generations 8 or 9, when somebody has moved from Massachusetts to Ohio to Illinois to Iowa, and sometimes records get lost. Sometimes towns don't have birth records, etc. So it's not the easiest trek to do, but we think it's well worthwhile once you've done it and once you get approved.
Okay, so you talked about this program. What else does the society do, the General Society of Mayflower Descendants?
We are very much involved with, again, as a member society, we have our own programs that we do lectures, we do children's events. We try to be involved with the community of Plymouth in terms of where I am at the international headquarters. But each of the different societies, the member societies in Mass, of the 54, have their own programs and events for their members. So if you or I were to join, depending on what member society we would do, there's things that they can do on the local level, as well as what I lead the staff at the international headquarters, some of the programs for the entire breadth and scope of the membership. Mm-hmm.
So you have 30,000 members, 35 million potential members out there. And so this is quite an undertaking. I actually, one tangible mark of this I see every year is my mother-in-law grew up in Provincetown. She was born there. Her father, as a boy, remembered the building of the Pilgrim Monument. And there you have stones that were donated by different Mayflower chapters around the country, contributed to the building of the Pilgrim Monument in Provincetown. And so there must be other, similar things in other parts. Are there other things in other parts of the country commemorating these works?
Without question. I mean, you mentioned about Provincetown, but all throughout the world, be it in Holland, be it in England, memorials and remembrances of Mayflower passengers and their descendants, in all forms and fashions. If it's a church, it can be records that they've left and documents that they've written. Obviously Plymouth, it's kind of the headquarters of what it is that what they did and where they were. One of the things that we inherited a few years ago was what we call the Mayflower Meeting House, a former church that the Unitarian community could not keep up, but a place where the Plymouth, where the Pilgrims and their descendants actually worshipped. And
really,
so this is the fourth iteration of that church.
Mm-hmm.
The building there is in the town square of Plymouth. So I'm not saying that the actual Mayflower passengers worshipped in that building, but their descendants did, and that's
okay.
The offshoot of it. Mm-hmm. And so we now own that building. We are fixing it up, restoring it, refurbishing it. Probably going to be a couple more years before it's all done, but that will be a place where we can educate and inform and hopefully entertain people about and get people to understand the impact that the Mayflower passengers had on world history. This is just like you're doing it with the Revolution. This is the beginnings of the country, you know.
It is. And of course, not only my mother-in-law, but my many friends in Provincetown would want to remind everyone that the Pilgrims first were in Provincetown for about 6 weeks before they went across the bay to Plymouth. And one of the big things that, of course, happened in Provincetown Harbor was the Mayflower Compact, which is really a world historical event that then helps lead to the Revolution. Can we talk a little bit about the compact and its impact?
Sure. This is really, there are people who think that this is the foundation for the Constitution, and, you know, it's kind of a byproduct of the Magna Carta. One of the really formulative documents in American history, and probably underappreciated, now there's been some artistic license where they show women involved. We know it was just the men, but this was a bond between the males that before they got off the ship, that they will make sure that they govern fairly, that they will look out for each other and support one another.
Right.
I think the impact of this document sometimes gets underestimated and underappreciated, but really, truly a formulative moment in American history.
Yeah, it really is. We're talking with Mark Schmidt, the executive director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants and in Plymouth, although it's a global organization with local chapters in each state or wherever you are. And now the Patriot to Passenger Program and other things involving the Revolution, I mean, that's an astonishing list of names that you have compiled of people involved in the Revolution who did have antecedents in Plymouth.
Sure. One of the great ironies for me is that on our property, we have a house that we've now called the Mayflower Society House that was originally built in 1754. That was owned by the great grandson of Edward Winslow. And I also named Edward Winslow, who happened to be a Tory, and many of these families become Tories and were ultimately moved to Nova Scotia. But there were also some very strident and very firm, what we now call revolutionaries, that fought for the Americans. And so this whole South Shore area in which we're located had a real tug and pull going on. There were moments in Plymouth history in which, you know, everyone knows about Plymouth Rock. But what you may not know is that early on, the rebels, if you will, the people, the revolutionaries, took the original rock and tried to drag it up to where the now meeting house that I referenced earlier is located. The rock split in two. And it was like a perfect break. And for many people in Plymouth, it kind of symbolized the fraction between the fledgling United States and Great Britain and England. So the half of the rock was dragged by a 20-horse team up to the meeting house. The other half was left where, you know, in the ground, in the sand. But this was a hot button topic for people, both that on both sides, that people that had been Mayflower passengers. There were some that were very supportive of England until the end. Others were very, very demonstrative about how they wanted to break free.
Right. And then some who were supportive of the crown wind up leaving for Nova Scotia.
Correct.
And so what motivates someone to go one way or another? Have you given this much thought in your work as, I know as an historian, you probably have given this some
thought. Well, I think it's, in its own way, it's the original Civil War. I think depending on how your economic status was, depending on what, your views on the monarchy were. I think it was an individual choice or a family choice.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of towns split one way or the other. It was not necessarily uniform, but I think every one of these passengers, every one of these citizens had their own things to wrestle with. You know, we obviously know about Benjamin Franklin's family, and in like right. his own son in was the governor of Jersey, who was clearly a loyalist. This is not just, and you know, he was not involved with the Mayflower descendants, but he was kind of indicative of some of the tug and pull that was going on. That a lot of these families were very torn.
So then, what happens to someone like Edward Winslow, who?
In his case, he, as you mentioned, he's one of the families that goes up to Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. He was the one who owned the house here. He was a pretty strident Tory. And I think after some time, he had kind of, I don't know if alienate would be the right word, but I think some of his local townspeople were a little, he'd kind of worn out his welcome with them. Yeah. He matriculates to Nova Scotia, and he dies there, as well as other families in the area. Now, that does not mean every Winslow was a Tory. I don't want to know that. But there were towns like Marshfield, towns that were split, you know, that had their pockets of support for the crown as well as support for the revolutionaries that certainly led to a lot of relocation in this region.
So then what happens to the house, say houses of someone who was a Tory?
Well, in this particular case, the house was essentially repossessed by the town, you know, because there were some debts on it. Some local merchants buy it and they occupy it. Later, you know, the house actually has an interesting history. In the 1830s, among the things that happened was Ralph Waldo Emerson gets married to the owner's daughter in the house, and later it's purchased by a family called the Willoughbys, who were a Chicago retail firm. But in this particular instance, this was a Tory home that was very, very well thought of. I mean, the house was a mansion, and it's taken over by the locals because they were they felt he had a debt to pay to the town that he hadn't paid, and then so they repossessed his home, and he at this point he had left, but so it wasn't that he was physically displaced, but it was kind of emblematic of some of the. Some of the troubles and travails going all throughout the area.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know Barnstable, which also had been settled by folks from Plymouth. I mean, it was a pilgrim community initially. It's the only town in Massachusetts to vote against independence in 1776. And, you know, of course, it's the home of the Otises. James Otis Sr. was the moderator of the town meeting. I believe his wife was a Mayflower descendant. Mm-hmm. So you have, and there it's torn. A lot of this, as you're saying, Winslow wore out his welcome. Some of it is political, ideological, other seem to be personal, that, you know, Winslow himself might have just been someone people were tired of.
That may have been, yeah.
Not to speak ill of the dead, but of course, if we as historians don't, who will?
Right. And one thing, too, about the story about the Plymouth Rock, it was put at the base of a Liberty pole that was outside of the meeting house. And the one of the uses of the house, a doctor that occupied the home, one of the first anesthetics was performed in that house as well. So at the time, it was known as the Edward Winslow House, and there's still people that do refer to it as the Winslow House even to this day.
So what would you call it if you didn't want to call it the Winslow House?
We call it the Mayflower Society House now. It's sort of, I mean, it's kind of our Nike swoosh. It's kind of our, it's what people recognize when they come to Plymouth and they come to the Mayflower Society headquarters. They know that house. You know, they may not know what office I'm in, but they know that house.
Okay. So we're talking with Mark Schmidt, who is the executive director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants, whose headquarters is in Plymouth. And let's talk a little bit about what else is happening in Plymouth, because I know there are a number of historical organizations there as well as The Rock. And once you've seen The Rock, there are other places where you can go and get more of the history, not only of the 1620s, but of subsequent years. So so does your society have a museum visitor center? Is that going
well,
to be
Well, the house is kind of our museum, if you will.
Right.
And once the meeting house is done, that'll be our real go-to spot. Obviously, everybody knows about Plymouth Patuxent, the former Plymouth Plantation.
Right.
The Pilgrim Hall Museum, which is the largest repository of Pilgrim artifacts. The Plymouth Antiquarian Society, both of those are downtown Plymouth. Mm-hmm. If you like history, Plymouth is a good place to go. And I think we're all working towards plans together and separately, plans for the revolution and the 250th anniversary. Obviously, for Plymouth, the town of, we all feel a little bit burned by 2020 and
sure.
COVID, and we were all looking forward to the 400th anniversary of the voyage of the Mayflower. And I think there's been some malaise and melancholy that has set in on what could have been and what wasn't. But it's,
right,
you know, such as it is. But
but people still come. It is America's hometown. There's lots to see there, lots to do there.
Yeah, absolutely. Downtown Plymouth in the summertime, and it's a lot of tourists here, and a lot of things to see and do.
Yeah, and there's a great seafood place right on the water too.
More than one.
more than one. There's one that I know very well. So yes, so we're talking, as I said, with Mark Schmidt, Executive Director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. So what other things are you doing? I mean, we've mentioned the Patriot to Passenger.
We really have begun to plan for things that take advantage of the Revolution 250. For example, this fall, we're going to have a walking tour of the places in Plymouth that do highlight some of the revolutionaries as well as some of the loyalists, and to let people see that know their backstories and what they were involved with. We do want to tell more stories, as we just mentioned, about the breaking of the rock and taking it up by the Liberty
Pole.
We want people to understand that Plymouth, the South Shore, we're very very much involved with what happened in 1775, that these descendants of who came in 1620 and passed were very impactful.
Yes.
150 years later, that in their own way, they had been revolutionaries 150 years before. And look, we fast forward to the number of leaders in this country, Franklin Roosevelt and others, presidents who have Mayflower lineage. Well, what you and Revolution 250 are talking about is dovetailed in with what we do here in Plymouth, and that from 1620 to 1775 to 1945 to 2025 are all part of a chronological chain of events that involve many of the same bloodlines. So we want to be able to highlight that, you know, things do move along from 1620, 21, 22 to 1775 to 1783 and beyond.
Right. And again, seeing what happens in a town like Plymouth, as you said, it is very much a civil war. You get a sense of these communities and families being torn apart by this. And it's not the same story necessarily we get on the Freedom Trail in Boston.
Absolutely. So for us, in many ways, with the Freedom Trail, it does start at 1775, or maybe, you know, in 1770. But for Plymouth, it does start in 1620. So we're thrilled to be teaming with Revolution 250 because we want to show that it's not static and it's not stationary, that right. that these people have families, obviously, or a lineage society, obviously they have families, but their impact continued, not just locally, but nationally and globally, throughout this era and beyond. So, you know, there's a lot of things that kind of get glossed over in talking about colonial history, but also in this period of time where we don't necessarily focus on American Revolution leaders having their ancestors possibly be from the Mayflower. One of the things that comes from Plymouth Colony is the development of representative government, town meeting. We can focus on the Sons of Liberty and Samuel Adams and the firebrand and everything, but the actual having a voice in the making of your town, it's great. And this goes back to what you asked about the Mayflower Compact, scent of the governed, So the thread that ties my organization and yours, that's why we joined. It is there for all to see.
Right. That is the fundamental thing. And we see that in 1774, with the suspension of the Massachusetts government and the town meetings. That's what brings towns which hadn't really been part of this into becoming revolutionary, because they were losing the power to govern themselves. And that's something that does go back to the Mayflower Compact.
Correct.
That fundamental idea. Yeah.
And as we mentioned before, to me, one of the great sad things is I don't think we give the Mayflower Compact its due as to how historically impactful it is. And again, so I'm glad to have this forum talking with you, because it does give voice and life and breath to a document that's still very much alive.
It is. And when we simply use a buzzword like freedom or liberty as the cause, we don't really understand what that means, really. And it is. I remember when Nelson Mandela got out of prison and he waited until he got to this rally site to utter his first words after being in prison for 26 years. And it was Amanzala. And I remember the American commentator saying, and his first word is freedom. And the South African commentator said, no, actually, Amanzala means power. And that's really what this was about. I mean, who governs and who does have power over our lives? Is it the king and parliament, or is it this community that we've been part of now for 150 years?
Correct. Absolutely. And it's also, too, one of the things that we kind of underestimate is the impact, too, of the women of the community as well. Mm-hmm. This was one of the things that we downplay how necessary they were for this generation to grow, to thrive, to ultimately become who they became. And so it wasn't just the men of the we focus on the men's names, but the women of the colony, the women on the voyage were incredibly impactful. And you know, we fast forward into the revolutionary times, and it wasn't simply Abigail Adams during that time, but a lot of other women as well. So
we're talking with Mark Schmidt, executive director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. So the rock, they move it up to the Liberty Pole, to the town square, and half of it or part of it. Mm-hmm. Do they put it back together again at some point?
Ultimately, it did get put back together. I think it was like in the 1870s, I believe, that they tried putting it back together. But obviously, over the course of time, water, wind damage, the rock is not the same size as it used to be. There's a big part of it is in the Smithsonian. So they actually did try to cobble it back together many years later, somewhat successfully, but now, according to James Thatcher, the historian of Plymouth, that really was the Rock, you know, and there's pieces of the Rock everywhere now.
What's the significance of the Rock?
Well, according to legend, that's where they stepped off the boat, you know, and landed. But it also does go back to your it's what it symbolizes. We don't know if their footprint actually touched there. It might have, but we don't know. More what it represents as opposed to what it's physically actually did. That this is where. In a lot of ways is where this country began,
I'm always a little skeptical though that in December you're going to be steering your boat toward a rock as opposed to toward a beach.
They meant to go to Virginia. then they stopped in Provincetown, so it's I don't think that was their original destination, that's where they ended up. So and then they obviously They let people back in England know about what became Massachusetts Bay Colony and what became Boston. So it's
So it was a rivalry between the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the Plymouth Colony or the old colony?
It was definitely a rivalry, but Massachusetts Bay was much more well healed, and Plymouth was obviously older, but it was never quite as powerful. One was separatist, one was Puritan.
Right. Yeah.
So they ultimately merged in 1693, I believe.
Okay.
Rivalry, I wouldn't say it was, out and out discord, but they coexisted.
Okay, good. Jonathan is this week down in Williamsburg, so I don't want us to say too loudly that this is where America began, because some of those Virginians might.
Well, I do tread lightly in that, so yeah. I don't want to upset the Jamestown folk or.
Well, it's just between you, just between us.
I'd say that with an asterisk.
Great. Yeah. It's also interesting that in 1876, you both have the Mayflower Society being formed. Also, the attempt to re-put the Rock back together. That is, these anniversary years often have people thinking back.
Right. Well, yeah. The Mayflower Society actually starts in 1897, but that's what kind of when people in 1876 they kind of start thinking lineage, So it's but you're right. It's right around there is when they're trying to re-weld the rock and cement it back together. All roads lead back to 1876 or thereabouts.
Right, the centennial. We had lasted 100 years as a country, and so time to reflect on how this happened.
It was Lincoln that kind of dubbed Plymouth as America's hometown, when talking about Thanksgiving. So it's,
yes, right. It's,
yeah. And so I think we kind of go back to the original original Civil War kind of thing. So
right. That's true. And if you think about it too, 1876 was just a decade after the Civil War, and 1976 was you had a tumultuous decade in American history. So it's time during really contentious times to think about what has held us together or what has what lasts.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going back to where I work, the Mayflower passengers left a turbulent time for them.
That's true.
They come and settle in the winter, as you point out. Half of them pass away that first winter, but 51 survive, and ultimately there's children born and families formed and towns made, and a lot of those descendants become fast forward to the 1770s and become very much involved in the Revolution, and later they obviously. Go across the country, around the world, and as we've mentioned before, there's about potentially 35 million that we can estimate as possible descendants.
Mm-hmm. Mark, if I can ask about relations with Native people, I know the Plymouth Plantation is rebranded as Plymouth Patuxet, and they do represent the Wampanoag people or the Patuxet people there. I wonder what the relationship is between the Mayflower descendants and Native Americans.
As far as we can, it's fine. I mean, yeah. Obviously at the Mayflower Society, our job is to prove lineage from the Mayflower passengers. So we haven't had anything of note that's bad, you know. You're right. The Tux has made it a point to try to make sure that things are seen well, and the Pilgrim Hall is trying to do things that are seen well, and we've tried to do our part as well. That we acknowledge that relations with the natives were good for the first 50 years. You know that there were everything wasn't perfect, but it wasn't until King Philip's War that got bad. So so the first generation got along well with the natives.
Yep. That is one of the big stories in the treaty, and which we commemorated a couple of years ago. And I'm wondering, actually, Jonathan has asked what someone who traces his or her ancestry to the Mayflower, then what is that you get out of something like this?
Well,
you trace your ancestry to those 51 people or the 100 people aboard the ship.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, for... You put in the work and you spend some time, and again there's some hoops to jump through to prove your lineage 14, 15 generations. You then become your membership papers and the things that you're submitting get submitted to Plymouth, where we verify it, and then you get a certificate that shows that you are a descendant of whichever, be it Alden, Winslow, Billington, there's a membership fee, but, we've got annual meetings, there's member meetings, there's publications that we do for the membership. So there are benefits, and it's kind of a more of a collegial club that a lot of the members refer to themselves as cousins, that you're a Brewster or a Bradford or or a cousin, and so it's kind of the innate feeling that that you put in the time, the effort to show that your ancestor is one of the following. We do keep a family tree, if you will, so when we can show that these are the descendants, and it's incumbent on us that when papers come here, that we prove that the membership is legit. We take it very seriously.
Yes,
we don't. This is not something you can just pay $50 and you're in, kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's work, there's hoops to jump through, there's work to be done. And we kind of pride ourselves on being a gold standard lineage, and we're very very adamant about that, we think that it's not the easiest club to get into, but one you're proud to be a member of once you join.
Are you a member?
I am not. I am not. I can speak from admiration of people who have done through it, and having met a whole lot of members, they are very proud and deservedly so. But I would be lying to you if I said I am a member, because I am not.
Okay, you're disinterested and
able to.
Disinterested as opposed to uninterested. I mean, you are very much interested in it, but it's a wonderful society.
I just haven't had the wherewithal to do my lineage. How's that?
Okay. That's good.
I've been working.
That's right. Yeah.
I haven't followed through yet. So
maybe when you retire.
Yeah. There you go. The Mayflower Society is not as big as the Daughters of the American Revolution mm-hmm. or the Sons of the American Revolution. DAR is the biggest. Mm-hmm. But again, we've got over 30,000 active members, and so we're very proud of that.
Very good. Very good. We've been talking with Mark Schmidt, who is the executive director of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants. It's been great talking to you, Mark, and finding out what the Mayflower Society is doing and what you were doing in Plymouth and beyond. And anything else we should talk about before we let you go?
It's just been a real honor for me to be with you and to work with Jonathan Lane. We're very very pleased and proud to be a member of Revolution 250. I hope my beloved PhD advisor William Fowler is still proud of me after all these many years. And
I'm sure he is.
It's just been a real pleasure to have chatted history with you.
That's great. Well, it's great to have the Mayflower Society with us and you with us. So thank you for joining. And I want to thank also Jonathan Lane, who is our producer, who arranges for the podcast. And he's been behind the scenes actually sending us questions to answer, which is good. And I want to also thank our many listeners around. You know, Mark, when we started this, we thought we would have a handful of folks maybe tuning in occasionally. But we have a very steady and very wide group of listeners, and every week I thank folks in different places who are tuning in. And first and foremost, our listeners in Plymouth. We have a hearty contingent of friends in Plymouth, as well as Ann Arbor and Detroit in Michigan, Tampa and Davenport in the state of Florida, of course here in Boston in all neighborhoods, Phoenix, Arizona, Melksham and Southampton in England, Owings Mills in Clarksville in Maryland, Sallisaw, Oklahoma. I want to thank you all for listening. If you're in one of these places, send Jonathan Lane an email, jlane@revolution250.org. He'll send you one of our Revolution 250 posters that tells you about all the events coming up in the next year and a half. And John at jlane@revolution250.org. And so now we will be piped out on the road to Boston.